Good evening, everyone. My name is Claire, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be sober and a proud member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd like to thank Debbie for calling me, and we get those calls, and my answer is always yes. And they call us usually maybe sometimes a year or whatever time that they're planning their committee and getting the speakers. And so over that time, we've become good friends, and I always am honored to be asked to come and share my experience, strength, and hope with you, which is a privilege. And I'm here again, and I want to congratulate you on this wonderful, wonderful conference. And I've seen so many sponsors, friends. Whenever I stand at a podium at anywhere in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I look out and I see you and I see the smiling faces, and I always one more time realize that I'm standing in the sunlight of the spirit of Alcoholics Anonymous and all its love, and I want to thank you for that. We tell our story in a general way, and I also want to thank Fernando for that introduction. Thank you, dear, for telling my age. And and David, and all of you have been so kind. Thank you. You know, we tell our story in a general way, what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. I was born in Atlanta, Georgia. We're not going to stay in Georgia too long tonight either. I remember what it was like, and I think, believe I'm one of the ones that had the ism long before, I ever saw the drink of alcohol. A little bit about my family. My father was a full-blooded Cherokee Indian of the Cherokee Nation. He was born and raised on a reservation in North Carolina, Cherokee, North Carolina. And as Fernanda told you, I was born in 1925. Which makes me 83 years old. And the best is yet to come. I'm the youngest of seven children, and my father left that reservation when he was 26 years old, and migrated down into Georgia and met my mom, and it's a rather detailed story. And there were seven of us, and as I said, I'm the youngest. My father moved us to Atlanta so that we could have a better education than we had in that little small town of Bainbridge, Georgia, in the central part of Georgia. And I was born in Grady Hospital. The rest of them were born in this little town. So growing up in Atlanta was not easy for me. My mom died when I was 3 months old and the youngest, and she was in her 40s and it would have been three miscarriages and seven of us that survived. My older brothers and sisters, as long as they were, they reached that age to, leave Atlanta, they did, because my father married a woman, and was what I would call today the evil stepmother. But I've had a lot, and so in Alcoholics Anonymous and doing inventories, and I've looked back on that. And at the time, I now know a lot of what I hated, and the people I hated, and the things I hated was my perception of them. And so that's been very helpful with this 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's especially the eighth and ninth step and doing that inventory. My father passed away when I was probably 14. My father was a very talented man and a very well-known artist, and we grew up in a very, what was considered at the time, very affluent family. And he was very famous, and so we had all those outside things that we were supposed to make us fit and be somebody. And I really always had those fears that we talk about, and one of the fears I had was really brought on by my attendance in that Union Baptist Church in Atlanta, and because that was my stepmother's I used to call it her madness, And her and that God, and I didn't do too well. And I remember being 8 and 9 years old and on my knees on that front, in that first pew, and them praying over me. And I was so full of fear and all the things they talked about. And I didn't know until later on that how much that was going to distract me from any sanity that was insane, but that was about to go on. When I graduated from Booker T. Washington High School in Atlanta, I won an art scholarship to the Boston Museum School of Fine Arts. And that's when I can remember sitting on a segregated train out of Atlanta. And I'm going to tell you, I was shy, and I hid from people. I didn't know how to function, actually. And yet, my older brothers and sisters had all been successful and nurses, and they'd gone on off. But there was always that loving interaction when they would come to visit. So I really kind of grew up as an only child. But I remember sitting on that segregated train out of Atlanta and giving Atlanta... And you know the ism, and I'm sitting there looking out the window. I never had friends. I was terrified. I wasn't allowed to play with other children. I was isolated from people. And I'm looking out of that window, and I'm that attitude, you know, that we hear about in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm saying, I'll fix them. Man, they didn't even know I was leaving town. And then... I'm really glad to tell you how old I am, because this was at the beginning of World War II, and it was an incredible time. And I remember going into Washington, and we changed trains, and I had never been in an environment where I, you know, accepted my people and my race. I'd never interacted with white people, and I was just, it was incredible to sit on the train and not be segregated. And I went into Boston, where my sister was a very successful career, and she was, and that's where I went into school, to the Boston Museum School of Fine Arts. You know, I had never seen alcohol, had never heard of it in the South in those days. This is around in the early 20s, because alcohol was a sinful thing. From Florida all the way over to Texas, almost, there was nothing legal about alcohol. I didn't know it existed on the earth. And I always loved music, and the only thing I liked about that church was the music. And I remember when I got into that school, I walked into that school, and it was always one of those things. Excitement lasted for about 2 weeks. And I kept wondering, there must be something more to this. And there I was, 19 years old, had never been to a movie, had never had a date. And I always had this curiosity about boys, and that stepmother told me to always stay away from them, but they were not nice. And so I had these these fears and about it. And I had never seen the movies, but I just liked the excitement, and they accepted me in that Museum School of Fine Arts, and I started going to the movies. I was fascinated by people up on the screen interacting. I'd never seen my father even embrace my stepmother. They were like very polite people, and I didn't know how people interacted with each other, and I just loved it. And so one night I'm walking down the a street after a movie with a friend from school, and I heard this music coming out of this club, and the streets were filled with servicemen, and the war was in. And I mean, it was just a very exciting time, and I heard this music come as these people walked out of the club. I later learned it was a jazz club, and it was a jazz era, and so I said to my friend Lenore, I said, why don't I just go in there and see what they're doing? And I walk in, and I shall never forget, it was dimly lit, and the aroma of the cigarettes and the booze, and at the end of this bar was this rather portly lady, and she's singing this blues, and my heart started to pound. And I just walk up there, and I sat on the stool, and the bartender leaned over, and he said, what are you going to have to drink? I had no idea. But I remembered in the movies they always talked about martinis. I was about to commit my first hip, slick, cool act. I leaned on that bar and I looked at the door. She didn't know, she hadn't had a drink either. And I said to him, "We'll have a martini, honey." I said, "Make it dry." I had no idea what a dry martini was. No idea what a dry martini was. And he turns around, I can now know it was a blender. And he puts these two lovely stem glasses up there and he evened it out. It looked like lemonade. And you know, in Georgia, it's hot as hell down there. And you know, pitchers of lemonade in those ice boxes, because I grew up when we didn't have refrigerators. And was always, and he evened it out. And I looked at it, and I looked at her, and I didn't know you sip drinks. Man, I picked it up. I looked up and down that bar, and I dumped it. Pig from the gate. But I remember how it made me, I remember how it made me feel. That trembling feeling that I remember from 5 years old. And you know, I looked around and there was a little dance floor, a little square dance floor, and these couples were dancing. And man, I took the empty glass and just stepped off that, got off that bar and walked down and stood by that dance floor. It was always in me, I wanted to do that. And they were dancing, and that night I got myself some new friends. I call them colorful. But the big book calls them loyal companions. And I hooked up with the pimps, the hookers, the madams, and the bad boys. I learned how to walk that walk and talk that talk. And I got to tell you, it lasted for a lot of years until I ended up where I ended up. It started to become a nightly thing for me, and hanging out in those clubs. And I want to tell you guys, and a lot of see all of you, a lot of you are young, but it was at the time we could walk into a club after club, and I walked in there and I could see there was Billie Holiday. So I stayed in that lifestyle for about 10 years in that jazz world. Billie Holiday, Louis Armstrong, Dinah Washington, and hanging out with them, you know, after hours, we go to after hour places, and I started that lifestyle, and I should never forget. And I then, you know, that thing about, you know, men, and I was kind of cute in those days, and I remember sitting on the bar one night, and my favorite bartender, Charlie, and this guy walked in. The mafia owned all the clubs in those days, Here comes this guy, and I was looking for Mr. Wonderful. That's what I named him. I didn't know he was going to come from somewhere, but I had some requirements. You know, he got to have a lot of money and, you know, let me, you know, do whatever I wanted to do. That was important. And I'm still a virgin, honey. And because in those days, it wasn't like it is. We just, you know, in walks this guy with two guys standing behind him, and he had a black hat turned down all the way around, and he had a light blue top coat over his shoulders, and he was so cool, he couldn't get his arms through the sleeves. And he turned out to be the head of the mafia of the Boston family, and he looked at me, and he reached in his pocket, and he pulled out a wad of money. It was 10 $100 bills. He spread it on the bar like a deck of cards, and he leaned over and he said, "Spend it." I didn't believe in God. But he'd answer my prayer on this one. And we were off and running. It was wonderful. And, you know, I remember, I'll just tell you one little thing about Billie Holiday. And I was sitting on a stool in that one afternoon in the hi-hat club, and she walked in, and she sat on the stool. She used to call me hun. And she said, "You know, I cut a record. We cleaned it up." They used to, in those days, they didn't have, like, the equipment they have now. They had reels. And they used to do all the recordings right in the clubs, and then they'd take them in and clean up the scratches and the noise. And she turned to me and she said, you know, she said, you got to buy this record, those big little 78s. And she said, because one of these days I'm going to be a legend. Little did she know. And then, so anyway, I stayed in the school, and then one night I met a nice young man I bought from a very nice Boston family, and we started dating, and he didn't drink, so we started to drink together, and everything. So I was off and running. But anyway, we got married, and my sister, as I said, was very well known in the community as an entrepreneur and a business person. And I come really from a wonderful family, and they all had in between New York and Boston. And you know, I started. We talk about the disease of alcoholism, and in the Big Book, which is the basic text of our program. Things started to happen to me, but I'm one of the real alcoholics, as it's described on page 21. And, you know, I drank for years without getting into real trouble because it became a lifestyle. I've learned the difference between a lifestyle and a life. Today I have a life far beyond any fantasy, and I was a person that was filled with fantasies. And so, we had a little son. And I got too busy, and I pushed him off on his grandparents to raise him. And this when I read in the book and I study the book continuously and the steps, and there's a part in the book when it says selfishness and self-centeredness that we think is the root of our troubles. And it goes on in that paragraph to say we're driven people. And we're driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. And so I was out there, you know, doing that dance, and it started to change. And my husband's family owned a trucking business, and he was out of town a lot. So I'm riding around with the mob. We go over to New York just to have a drink. And I remember a lot of you older, if you really know a little about the jazz world in New York City. Birdland was opening, and we drove over to the opening of Birdland, and Billy Eckstein was the opening performer, and it was great. But it was that time when we arrived back in Boston. It was like early on a Sunday morning. It seemed to me that the God I've come to believe in would always seem to get my attention on Sunday morning. And I'm sitting in the back of the limousine, you know, dying inside. Looking good and dying inside, and we're about 10 years into this now, and we had gotten married, and I never finished the school because every life was too exciting doing whatever I was doing, and so when we was at the corner of one of the streets in front of a beautiful New England church, and it was on a Sunday morning. My son is 10 years old, you know, and I've gotten too busy to visit him and take it. All the promises I couldn't keep. You know, I used to say to him, but baby, next time I come over, he said, well, Mom, you promised me the last time. When you come, you're going to take me just to the park. I know, baby, but next time. So how I would resolve that is, you know, I just send more expensive toys and more expensive camps. And I try to buy off the love. I know the difference between buying love. You know, and giving love. That's a whole different thing for me today. And so he was 10 years old at this time, and I look across. I'm sitting at the red light, and I'm sitting in the back with the mob, and oh, Jesus, I can't even tell you about those guys. And they had the guns on the floor. And this is a time when in that era when they were really, you know, warfare among the gangsters. And I'm sitting there, and my husband's out of town, and I see this young family about to cross the street. And I look over my shoulder, and it was this beautiful New England church. And it was like a voice said to me quietly, Clara, something is wrong with your life. And I agreed. The problem was Boston. What we need to do is get out of town. He came in off the road, and And I told him, I said, you know, because his aunt and uncle were very famous in show business in California. So he agreed. So we you know, alcoholic. I'm willing to a few years now, but I'm still functioning. I was a functioning drunk for years. Never even had blackouts during the day. But you know the behavior. I mean, I'm into it. And so we buy this car, and we put this kid in the back seat of this car. We started for Los Angeles on Route 66, right into L.A. And I went there with good intentions. And you know, my intentions always changed, because once I took the drink took me. And I gave it the power, because I couldn't stop drinking. And we arrived in L.A., and the sister greeted us, and I was going to be one of those mothers. I knew what it was to be a lady. My Indian father, that was his greatest wish, that we would always be ladies, Southern ladies, as he called us, and be successful in life and to be dependable and all those things that I am now because of the grace of God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the life that I have today. We rolled in there and we got busy. He got a job and I by fluke went into a little small business. I was waiting to go into the school system, and we noticed that my drinking started to progress to the point I started having blackouts, and then that business became successful. My sisters and brothers who all lived on the East Coast, as I said. Came to visit, and they all moved out there, and they brought their careers with them. And it was six of us, at the time. And one brother had stayed in New York. So I was busy, getting ready for them and everything. And then it began to change. And I'm going to tell you something about crossing that invisible line. I had one sister who was a nurse at Cedar Sinai in Beverly Hills. And I began to lose it all, thank you, God, that you took away from me everything I wanted in order to give me what I needed. It came that time in my life when I needed to give up all those outside things that never made me happy. It just made me want more. And so when I was standing over with the, where was I? Oh, yeah, I went to the hospital when I started to have blackouts. Yeah, I need a hospital now, honey. for the mind. I went over to Cedars, and I remember the older sister was sitting at the desk. And I said to sister, I said, you know, we're going to lose the house. The bank has repossessed all my equipment and my business. I had this very successful company, and I said, I just need two more payments to save the house. And she looked at me like people who love us look at us. And I could see that pain in her eyes. But you know, the guilt and the shame that I stood there looking at her. And we came from that kind of family. We never were expected to be in that position. And she said, it pains us to watch you live the way you live. It's going to pain us even more to watch you die. And my fears from that Baptist church about death, I turned and I went out of there, and that older son, I'd had these two other kids, and my youngest child was my daughter, the next son was my son Ken, and the older son's name was Brent, the one was born in Boston. And he's now about 19 years old, and he's gone. He just can't handle me anymore. And that husband and I was into blackouts, and I'm ending up in places like County General Hospital in downtown L.A. And you know, that's not one of your favorite HMOs, you know, the County General. the husband and I, we drank drink for drink in that relationship. We did all those things that you do when you're in that kind of lifestyle. But he apparently had better control than I did. He wasn't in the black house, and I was now being beaten up on the streets, and they were all looking for me. And And I went back to the front of that house, and the oldest son came, and the husband was gone. He looked at me one day with that kind of look that we'd been married almost 25 years, and he said, you know, I can't go on with this, you like this. Either you're going to kill me or I'm going to kill you. And I cannot let the children see this. And he left. And there I was with these two younger ones and the older ones, and I went back and stood in front of that house, and the marshal was putting the lock on it and locked up everything in it. Everything was gone. And we're sitting on the steps. I had one friend left, an Israeli friend, who's still my friend, 40-some years now. And she had left a little envelope and some money in it. And they'd all been praying for me. And I believe it's the prayers of those who love us that brought us to my moment, when I stood in front of that house. And I just remembered having that little envelope. And the oldest son came, and he stood there, and he had blue eyes, and he looked at me, and he said, I don't know who you are. You've never been there for us. But I reminded him that we had never physically or verbally abused him. But I know today, my behavior, it was my emotional behavior is I damaged them all, you know. And then through these years in Alcoholics Anonymous, that's been the work I've worked on the family after. And he said, I'm walking away from here. He said, because I want to tell you, he said, bitch, I don't want to see you again. And I stood there. The two were sitting on the steps. And I opened the envelope, and my arrogance was, and screw you too. Because you don't know, if I knew better, I'd do better. I'm doing the best I can. That was my defense. I had knew nothing about alcoholism. I called a cab. And he arrived. And I handed him this envelope. He looked in there and he said, lady, he said, this is the ghetto of South Central Los Angeles. And my attitude was, whatever. I get in that cab with two young, my Tina was probably about 9 or 10 years old. Ken was at the time about 12, 13. And we get over there, and I had never been at that section of LA. And I shall never forget, I paid him, and when I look at these, this is the ghetto, and it's a little cottage, and I walk up the steps, and I walk into a little one-bedroom, dingy, dirty place. And my friend had arranged with the people who owned it, if I ever got there, that would be a place for me. And I drew the drapes, and I'm sure I was doomed to die of this disease. And the kids are looking at me with that look. And we got on with it. And I want to tell you, by that time, I had gone from drinking out of Baccarat crystal glasses and running with the most famous celebrities in the world, and I had become a winette. And more about alcoholism, it explains the things we sometimes do to keep from doing step one, two, and three. And in that list of insanities, one of them said, we switched to natural wines. Man, I had switched to Ripple. You know, one of your natural wines, I don't think a grape's ever been near that stuff, you know? I drew the drapes. I bought myself, for my journey, a white terracloth robe and a bright red wig that had bangs. And I used to get drunk and trim the bangs. It got bad. The grandparents moved out from Boston, bought a house, and took the kids. And so I drew the drapes, and I'd come to out of those blackouts. That's when they had black and white television. And I'd come to, and I'd be staring at and watching it flip over, and my heart would start pounding, and I missed the good old days. And I started frequenting the local bars down off of Weston and Slauson and those areas where it was tough down there. And I would want to hear the music. I always loved the music. And I'd get out of there and I'd struggle over to the nearest bar, crawl up on that stool. I love sitting on that end stool and looking in that mirror. Probably feeling like Eleanor Rigby, you know, wonder where all those other lonely people were coming from. And this and sawdust on the floor and drinking out of the barrel, you know, whatever was in that wine. Somebody didn't even have labels on the bottles and listen to the talk, and then I pass out, and sometimes I in a blackout, and sometimes I would wake up in front of that little cottage, and they call them California cottages, they just little one room dumps, and it wasn't about maintenance anymore, and the beautiful home and the beautiful life I'd always lived in from even a little kid, and I come through at that awful hour of the morning. 3 and 4 and 5 o'clock in the morning in a fetal position in tall, wet grass. And in those days, the garbage cans were metal. And I would lie there in that grass and make deals with a God I didn't believe in and see, you know, dogs that travel in packs in the ghetto and they would be searching. It was all about survival when you live under those conditions and in that lifestyle. And then they would take these dogs, several of them, and I could hear them, and they'd push the can over looking for garbage, and I could still hear the lid rolling down the street. It would wobble down to quiet. My heart is pounding. I'm making deals with God. If you just get me off the ground this morning. And I'd struggle up and get up those steps and get down those that hallway into a dirty bathroom on my knees. Chin sliding around on cold porcelain, and there were times when it seemed as if I was going to throw up my very soul. And I'd come to leaning my head against the toilet, and the two words that always greeted me was American Standard. Get up off that floor, you know. And I don't know what happened. I didn't visit the kids anymore, and I was just in there dying, and I gained 65 pounds, and I had wine sores now on my face, and open sores. And I don't know what happened one morning that was different from the other mornings, and I came out of a blackout. And I will always say that I believe this program was divinely inspired. When I studied the book and through the years, I had never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous, and there it was. In April the 9th, 1974, and I remember getting up off that floor that morning, and I don't know what was different. But when I talk about that Baptist church in Atlanta, one of the things, as I said earlier, is I always loved was the music. And I stood there and I started to weep. And I just, all I could say was, God, please don't let me die. That was my prayer. And I have learned, you know, we keep it simple. And that was a simple prayer that saved my life. And as I stood there in that room, in that dirty room, I don't want to ever forget this, the stench of a dirty body, and I had lost the will to care. And I'm standing there crying, and I'm saying, God, I'm afraid to die. And I believe what happened to me was a divine intervention. The Spirit of God must have kissed me gently and said, child, you don't have to live like this anymore. And I walked to the phone and I called my friend Rachel. And when I've looked back over this, I believe what happened was that when I was in that church, in Union Baptist Church, and we used to sing spirituals. And I remember one of the spirituals we used to sing when I sang in the junior choir. That's the only part I liked about that church, was that singing in that junior choir. And those spirituals were written by, all the books were yellow pages, because for years that's all they used, had to go by. And most of the lyrics were, the authors were unknown, because those lyrics were written by the slaves, my people, in the fields of Georgia. And then they put their pain in their souls into that music. And one of the songs that I remembered was the one that always touched me, even as a kid, when the lyrics went something like, "Soon one morning, death came knocking on my door. Oh my Lord, what shall I do?" And that was my moment. And I went to that phone and I called Rachel and I said, "Rachel, I think I'm gonna die if I don't stop drinking." That was the first time I admitted in my innermost self that I was gonna die if I didn't stop drinking. And she told me about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I picked up the phone, and she said, "She's not an alcoholic." She said, "I don't know what they do, but they help each other stay sober." And I pick up the phone and I call the operator. I said to the operator, "Is there any place called Alcoholics Anonymous?" And she said, "Yes, dear, I'll put you right through them." She's probably not a recovering alcoholic. So she knew right away. She said, "Yes, dear, I'll put you." And a man answered. He said, Good morning. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. May I help you?" And in my best street language, I said, "Man, I said, my name is Clara and I can't stop drinking." He said, "Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous." And he said, "Do you think you can stay sober, just don't drink today?" And I thought about it. Nobody had ever asked me to stay sober for a day. They just say, when we gonna drink again? You know, I said to him, I paused and I said, "I think I can do that." And something touched me, because I knew something touched me, and I said, "I think I can do that." And he told me where we go to the meeting and where we, you know. I got him on the phone, and here's what I say to him after he explained how to go to the meetings. I said, "Do you have meetings in Beverly Hills?" And he said, "Yes, we do, honey, but you go in the meeting in your neighborhood." I said, "I can do that." I can do that. And so I started to get dressed that morning for my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was 34 years ago. By God's grace. My brother worked at Delta Airlines, LAX, and I called him. His brother, he was the youngest of the boys. And I said, "Ike," I said, "I think I found a place for me. It's called Alcoholics Anonymous." And the man told me on the phone how they were going to help me stop drinking. And he said, he worked the night shift. And I said, "But I need a car, because my Cadillac, was everything was gone." And so he said, "I'll drop off the car." I said, "But I need a car to go, because I'd been down there 3 years without transportation, except those who would ride me home." And and they stayed. So he dropped off his car that morning. I'll never forget him running up the steps. I'm standing, I'm shaking like a leaf. I'm just shaking, and I'm bloated, I'm red, I'm just a mess. And I stood by the door, and as he walked in, he hugged me. He said, "I hope this is gonna work for you. We love you, and we just hate to see you live like this." And that morning, I started to get dressed. I went in and I got the wig. I didn't. Looking good almost killed me out there. Because I didn't know what you guys were about. You know, I wanted to look pretty good. I was a mess, but I wanted to look good. So I went in, I looked in the closet. I had one dress. It was a red velvet dress. This is April. And and it had wine stains all over the front of it. And I cleaned that up. I got a little soap and water and a brush, cleaned that up. And that wig, I put it on the headphone, and I cut some better bangs. I brushed it out, you know, and she looked pretty good sitting there. And I didn't know about detox. About 10 o'clock, I'm starting to shake and scratch. I was already scratching from the sores, and I thought, well, you know, I started busying myself, and I was started to jerking around. I didn't know I was detoxing. So around 12 o'clock, I couldn't stand it. There was a Woolworths 10-cent store near where I lived. And so I shuffled over there. I put on my bad leather jacket, put on my dark glasses, and, you know, I went over there. And I was just trying to kill time to the 7 o'clock meeting. Alorma knows it, my dear Alorma. And so she knows where that meeting is. And so I was getting all myself together. So I decided that I stole some eyelashes for my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I put them under my jacket. I got back to the house, and by the 6 o'clock, and perspiration is pouring off me, and I'm like a motor. I can't. So I got in the mirror, and I got the dress on. I got the wig on, looking good, and these eyelashes are the last thing to put on. And man, I'm shaking. They come with a little tube of glue. I got them. I didn't know you're supposed to cut them down to size. I squeezed it along the edge of the lash, and I waited for an opportune moment. And I slammed it in. And one end is up here, and the other end's down there. I'm too tired to start all over. I lean in the mirror. I say, "You are looking good." I went off to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's where my journey began. And I sat in that meeting that night, and the late Gail Wilson was the speaker. And she touched my soul, and I'm sitting there shaking. When we got in those days, along with could tell you, we didn't know about detox, and we just sat on our hands, and the old times would come with a jar of honey. And they were shoving in our mouths when we go in. I've seen people go into convulsions when we got sober. And she went to the podium, and she started to talk about things I'd never heard another person talk about. Talk about loneliness and talk about fear. And she'd been an airline stewardess, and I remember that night. And she talked about being in Paris and calling her mother back in Kentucky and saying to her mother, "I'm so lonely." And her mother said, "How can you be lonely in Paris?" And she said, "I'm lonely wherever I take me." And boy, I heard stuff. And I got to tell you, and that was the beginning. At the coffee break, I had poured too much coffee in the real coffee cups. And this woman came up to me, touched me on my shoulder, and she said, "My name is Carol." She said, "I'm going to be your sponsor," because in those days the meetings were so small. They volunteered to sponsor us, and that started off a journey with that, and it started off my journey with in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and service, and that was the beginning. You know, and the family after, and I looked at those kids, and I got into the fourth step and made the amends, and I got to tell you, it was painful because I was too sick to work. I had to still live on welfare and food stamps for 6 months after I was sober because I couldn't. I had gotten sober because I couldn't. I wasn't employable. I couldn't work. So my first job was as a waitress, and I said, "Me, waitress? Listen, honey, I'm a mob. You know, they used to give me thousands of dollars." She said, "You don't live with the mob nowadays, darling. You get a job." And so, and I did, and one thing led to another, and the kids started to come back to my life. You know, and the promises started to come true, and I made my amends to that family. And I want to talk about my kids, and that my son, the son that walked away from me in front of that house, and he said, "Bitch, I don't know who you are, and I never want to see you again." And he was grown up, and he'd become quite well known as a performing actor. and awards and in television, and he was doing very well. And he was in New York, and he was at the time, he'd done shows on Broadway and Talk About the Promises and Coming True and watching that. And by this time, I'm devoted to Alcoholics Anonymous sponsorship and active as I still am, because that's what keeps me sober by God's grace and God's love. So I flew to New York to see him, and he was working at ABC Television at the time in the news department. This is in the 80s, in the late 80s and early 90s. And so I heard somebody mention the Studio 54, and he was in that crowd. And of course, he was wonderful. And he called me and he said, "Oh, Mom," he had his gold chain, and we didn't know anything, you know, in those days about AIDS and how anything about it. And I can still see him now, and he used to call me and say, "Mom," he said, "you know, well, I'm having the time of my life." And he'd talk about the cocaine on the back of the toilets in Studio 54. He said, "Mom, it's like a mountain. We could go skiing on it." And then when his contract was over, he worked in the news department for the anchors like Barbara Walters at the time was just starting in the news department, in that part of that the ABC. And that's what he did. And so he came home when his contract was over, and he got married, and we had become friends, and I made my amends. And I want to tell you, that fourth step with all of my kids was so precious to me as I look back on it today. The two younger ones were still in L.A., and I sat them down, and that was painful, to admit to them that, you know, that I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but to admit to them what I had not been the mother that they deserve. And the younger ones, they don't understand, but somehow we worked through that. But when that older son came to Los Angeles, and I talked to him, because I was 4 years sober before I ever saw him, you know, and I told him my story, and I said, "If I'd known better, as I've said to you, I would have done better." He said, "Mom, that was yesterday," and it was gorgeous. He was just so spiritual. And then he went on up north to San Francisco and was teaching theater at the college level, junior college level, and I got a call from him. And by this time, I am submerged in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've gone back 3 years, when I was 3 years sober, I went back into that business of my company today, and I was very busy and active. He called me, he said, "Mom, I don't feel well, but I went to the doctor yesterday, and they told me I've got something called HIV. And I said, "Well, what is that?" He said, "I don't know." And I get on the plane, and I fly up there, and there's a son that I couldn't take him to the park because I was too busy. Thank you, God, for Alcoholics Anonymous. And we walked around San Francisco with my arms around his shoulders, and we talked, and I went to the doctor, and he said, "We don't know very much about this." He said, "But we don't have medication, but we'll do whatever we can." And he said, "Mom, you go home, you go back to L.A., and when it comes the time that I can't take care of myself," he said, "I'll call you. I have lots of sponsees, and I want to tell you, if you're new tonight, you never have to do anything alone again. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous and loving God in our midst always. You will be here to accept the love that God will send to you." So I'm telling you, the old timers, Alabama and alone, and everybody gathered around. And 19 months later, I get that call, "Mom, I'm too sick to take care of myself. And I'm coming home." And this time I had a place for him. And took care of him. I let my people that work for me run my company and my daughter and the other son. And they gathered around, and he had done some work for the Grateful Dead. And they had written some lyrics. They heard he was dying of AIDS. And they sent some roses and some lyrics. And my son, before he had lost the ability to talk, and you know, I used to feed a straw in water, put it on his lips, and he read me a note. I want them to sing when I cross over. And he was a very spiritual young man, and came that morning, 10:15 on a Saturday morning, that rasping sound of death. And I stood there and I held his hands, and then it was quiet. And I prayed that his soul rode the wings of angels to a higher place, no more crying and no more dying and no more pain. And, you know, we got on with our lives, and I was able to see my that daughter, Tina, go into the ice capades. The grandparents sent her to the training, and to see her go into the ice capades with one of the first black ice skaters, female skaters, with the Dorothy Hamill tour. And all my babies, oh, we just went, you know, she would skate when they came to L.A., we, you know, to go to see them, all my AA friends. She's now married and happily married, and I want to tell you, the men's steps, and they all go on, but I'm going to tell you, it's been difficult because we have, it's principles before personalities, and I, you know, you just can't, I'm a double winner because I'm also a member of Al-Anon, and I went to my Al-Anon, my sponsor sent me to Al-Anon with her, and it took all these years. It's only 3 years ago that we've had a loving relationship. We've always had a surface relationship, you know. And three years ago, I was able to finally let go and let God. You know, I've given all I can give, and I can't give anymore. And finally, she called me, and we had an unpleasant situation on the phone. And I had the courage. It takes courage. You know, the book tells us we are not doormats, and no matter what it is, you know, there comes that time when you have to stand up for yourself. And so, and we had this little discussion, and I got to tell you, I said, don't ever call me again, because I have called you with love, and if you feel the way you feel, which was cold, and you know, I'm not taking our inventory, but that's the way it was. So we don't give up. God in time, this is what I say, God in time will take care of the healing if we continue to do what we're supposed to do here. And when we had that discussion, one week later, you know, she called me and she said, Mom, let's go into therapy together. And I've chosen, and we have the best relationship. We took responsibility for our parts, and that's all about program. You know, she... my granddaughter, gorgeous granddaughter, is graduating from high school June the 5th. And that son, Ken, I want to talk about him. that's my gay son. when I was new and I was just gone to Al-Anon, because he started drinking and drugging when he was like 18. And I would come home from work and I'm, you know, and he's drunk on my couch. Honey, this will not do. No, this will not do. I'm not out there working and you're on the couch. And I had the courage. It takes courage to take the action. I remember one day my Al-Anon and my AA sponsor and all my friends said, you can't let him stay home drunk while you're working. So I came home one day and I had the courage and I said, God, you know, grant me serenity to accept the things I cannot change and the courage to change the things I can. That's my daily prayer every day, three times a day, the 11th step for me now. And I went in and I said, Ken, you can't live here. You can't live here drinking drugs. And I put him out on the front porch and he looked at me and he said, but Mom, where am I going to go? I said, you know, God loves you. He'll take care of you just like it took care of me. And that was the hardest thing I had to do. But I did it, and it took courage to do that. And he was in and out of the program. He finally got sober, in and out. He attempted suicide three times since that time. And 3 weeks ago, he got 5 years. He has hepatitis C. He's He has never, you know, and yet he's gone back to school, and he's on the dean's list, and he was in a treatment program for 1 year, and he's going to school, he's going to be a therapist, and he's already working for the treatments, one of the ones in L.A., one of the really big ones in L.A., and he took me to dinner for for Mother's Day. And he sat across the table from me, and he said, "Mom," he said, "you know, I never knew it could be so good. And thank Alcoholics Anonymous," and he said, "your prayers," because it is the prayers. And I got to tell you, I stand here tonight, and I want to tell you what it's like now. And I shared a little this afternoon about my, I have a sister. And I come from that large family. My sister is 94 years old. And she's just showing signs of dementia. And it's been a pretty rough year, and a lot of other things have happening. But I have come to believe the power of God in my life. And it's so simple that every morning I get on my knees and to see her now with her mind going to this woman who's was one of the first black graduates of Boston University School of Business, and 40 years as a government employee in Internal Revenue, and to see her mind going, and I get on my knees and I thank God that I can be here and be of service to her. And I placed her in a place where she will never come out, and so I ask your prayers and. The rest of life goes on. And I stand here and I can only say to you, thank you for having me. God bless you with all my love. Thank you. Thank you. We will always